بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يحمل على مكروه سواه، والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله خاتم الأنبياء وخاتمهم، وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين، وعلى أصحابه المخلصين المجاهدين. Brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'd like to begin by saying, speaking about the Imam Hussein alayhi salam wa radiyallahu an, is a subject matter that is not as clear cut, as obvious, as crystal clear as his position was. What has happened in almost 14 centuries is an accumulation of traditions and conventions and customs on all sides that to speak about an Imam Hussein just in an objective manner has become very difficult. It's become very difficult because on one side it is charged with a lot of emotions. On the other side, it is almost passé. And so when you come to speak about an issue as central and as sensitive as the lifetime and the last days, and then finally the shahada, the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam wa alayhi ridwan, it's unavoidable that 1400 years of the cumulative effect that we have on both sides of looking at this personality is unavoidable. Therefore, I will say to you to begin with, if I express whatever I express, it comes out of my heart and my mind, and I don't mean to trample on anyone's feelings. I don't mean to demean anyone, whatever your background is, whatever conviction you have, whatever persuasion you come from. I don't mean any of that. I'm just trying to speak the truth about this matter as I humbly see it. And let me say that in the many observations throughout the years that I have on this subject, that inevitably when a person evokes the lifetime and the struggle and the tragic ending of the life of Imam Hussein, may Allah's peace be his, when a person looks at this in the full spectrum of its ever-expanding meanings. My observations have been throughout the years that it solicits most of the attention of the Muslim public. Doesn't matter what type of Muslim public we're speaking about. If there's an article in a newspaper about Imam Hussein, or about Shi'is, or about Sunnis, you'd see almost everyone zeroing in on this matter and then responding to it or replying to it more than almost any other issue. I can tell you, we've been living in the recent past, and the issue of Sunni Shi'i has come out very frequently, especially by those who wish no good for the Muslim public in the world. if these were newspaper articles, or if these were dissertations or researches on the subject, they still solicit much more attention than even issues that have to do with our common destiny, such as the occupation of Palestine or the occupation of Mecca and the Medina. Now, let me make a comment here before I begin my short discourse. Many times, certain rulers in Islamic history are referred to as khulafa or khalifas, which is the plural of khalifa. And we just heard in some of the presentations that preceded me a reference to Yazid and Muawiyah as being two khalifas. I take very strong issue with that. And it happens to be that those who consider themselves Sunnis and those who consider themselves Shiites, both portions of the Muslim Ummah, feel comfortable, for their own reasons and their own explanations, they feel comfortable referring to Muawiyah and Yazid and the rest of the rulers that would follow after them as khulafa or khalifas. I don't think that's the case. I think these were kings. Khilafa is a form of governing that tried its best, and I'm trying here to skip over a lot of details, that tried its best to live at the standards that were left to that first generation of Muslims by Allah's final prophet. And that ended, for all practical purposes, with the rule of Imam Ali alayhi salam. After that, there's no khilafah, there's no khulafa. I know this is a bold statement. I know that many of you are not accustomed to hearing this, but I'm saying it out of my heart and out of my mind. So whenever I speak about Muawiyah or Yazid or these others from Bani Umayyah and Bani al-Abbas and the rest that came after that, just simply call them kings or monarchs. Let's clear the air on this subject. So when Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, when he came to assume the responsibility that has in the course of the previous years had been receding, and that is those who are qualified to lead the Muslims should lead the Muslims, not a drunkard like Yazid. Yeah, this is blunt language and this is the way it's supposed to be. And we have to express these facts without trying to score points. Some people, when they come and try to express these issues, as if there's a grudge against other Muslims. The grudge is misplaced. There should be, if there is to be a grudge, and if there is to be pent-up feelings, they should be against the rulers over the Muslim, not the general Muslim public. So when Imam Hussein came to this deteriorating political condition that the Muslims had found themselves in, he didn't just reach that moment out of nowhere. Karbala and Ashura did not just happen. Karbala and Ashura were in the making. They were in the making for some years. And of course this has history, and it basically, I know I'm here, I'm going to maybe tax some of your minds, but what was taking politically, and so this is another area that Muslims get confused, Muslims began on a political deviation course early in their history, but not on a social deviation course. Or not on a moral deviation course and these other things. We get confused many times. But we should be fair to the issues. So when that political corruption set into the Muslim body politic early on in the generation of Imam Hussein and in the generation before him, what happened was, and here's where I'm going to maybe say something that's not conventional. Here is where, you know, you see, in the history of Bani Israel, you know, there's many ayat in the Quran, not many people tie the history of Imam Hussein with the history of Bani Israel, or the history of the enemies of Imam Hussein with the history of Bani Israel. What happened in the course of Israeli scriptural history was that Bani Israel wanted to monopolize their relationship with God to the exclusion of the rest of humanity. And that's why the Quran refers to them as Bani Israel, because they gathered around a concept of asabiyya. That's an Islamic word which roughly translates to clannish solidarity. The first expression of this clannish solidarity was in the first generation of Bani Israel. La Yusuf wa akhuhu ahabbu ila abina minna wa nahnu usba. This is the first statement that describes to us the psychological deviation that was later on going to manifest itself in ideological and political positions assumed by Bani Israel. So the Quran refers to this character and this type of behavior. What was to happen in the time of Imam Hussein was there was going to be a replay of this dynamic by another crowd of people called Bani Umayya. Bani Israel, Bani Umayya. And then Imam Hussein was at the appropriate time to take the necessary action against this deviation. That wasn't a creation of its own. You see, this struggle many times is presented as one of a hostility between Imam Hussein and Yazid ibn Muawiyah. And to a certain extent that is true. But that is a partial presentation of the larger fact of the matter. The larger fact of the matter is that there is a tendency in societies to monopolize power on the basis of asabiyya. And this is, you see, the transformation that happened in the time of Allah's Prophet brought people, a society that was a type of nomadic society, brought it out of its status quo way ahead into the future. And the type of people who were there could not sustain this transformation. This breakthrough transformation that happened in the time of Allah's Prophet would, as human nature and the nature of society of that time and that place, would begin to recede at the expense of al-haq and al-adl. And this manifested itself with Banu Umayya assuming power on the basis of this asabiyya, of this clannish solidarity, which in today's world can be called nationalism, or its cousin, racism, or a parallel to that, you can have sectarianism. All of these can serve as a basis of asabiyya, clannish solidarity. So if you think about yourself as a nationalist and are trying to remember Imam Hussein, or you're thinking about yourself as a person whose race is superior to other races, and at the same time you think you belong to an Imam Hussein, or that because you belong to a certain sect, and you can trace even that sect to an Imam al-Husayn, then you don't know the contradiction that you are living. You're in a sect. I say this with respect, but as I said at the beginning, I'm trying to express the truth. In a sense, you are an oxymoron. You can't belong in a collective manner to Yazid and then psychologically belong to an Imam al-Husayn. It doesn't work that way. But this is what we have. This is the truth of the matter. Unfortunately. Even those who want and would like and desire to live and remember and demonstrate the idealism and the heroism of an Imam al-Husayn in today's world, you look around and you see, are they free of the same forces that assaulted and then martyred an Imam al-Husayn? Are you free of that? You see, when Muawiyah and Yazid came to power, they didn't come to power in a vacuum. They played up the spirit of nationalism in their own people. That's why they had a lot of people on their side. Of course, they combined with that other factors. And it's not easy to argue against the type of nationalism that, or racism, or sectarianism that undermine Islam. It's not easy to argue against it. Because in the minds of those people who say, we are practical, we are not reckless, we are not idealists, we are not revolutionaries, we are not crazies. We are pragmatic and we are practical. This is the argument that extends itself in defense of nationalism. So an Imam al-Husayn, as far as characters are concerned, true. Muawiyah and Yazid were enemies. But the picture is much larger than that, because the enemy here is not an individual. If it were just two individuals who were against the Imam al-Husayn and his father, Imam Ali, alayhi as-salam, wa radiyallahu anhuma, if these were just two characters, we wouldn't have had this history. But we had individuals who were ahead of their time, who now were being targeted by the clannish solidarity of their own people. That would be like in our time, in today's world, a person who belongs to the Arabic context or to the Persian context or the Turkish context or whatever, taking issue with the nationalism of that context and then being killed by the nationalists of that context. But how many of us understand this lesson of Karbala and Ashura? How many of us understand it that way? I mean, this can be traced, we can go back. I mean, some people do mention this very frequently. When they recall the history of Imam al-Husayn, they mention Abu Sufyan, and they mention Muawiyah, and then they mention Yazid. But unfortunately, when they do speak about these personalities, they don't speak about the social forces that were behind them. And therefore, when we come now, We had almost 1,400 years ago to rethink, recast, and represent this issue so that everyone would understand what it means. Whether you're a Muslim or you're not a Muslim, everyone knows what nationalism means. And I know that there some people will make an argument for a positive nationalism, and others will make an argument for a negative nationalism, and these things. I don't want to open up that can of worms. Suffice it to say that nationalism, as we understand it in today's world, which is the cousin of racism, which is also the relative of sectarianism, this type of force is in us. If we take a look at our internal selves, we will take a look at the powers that were cast against Imam al-Husayn. We find it in our social and cultural selves. If people understood that Imam al-Husayn, why do we have nationalist misajid? I ask you that question. The type of masajid we have is supposed to be an Islamic center. It's supposed to be for all Muslims, regardless of the type of backgrounds that they may come from. It's an open house, an open door for every Muslim. But you take a look around. I don't live here in this city, but I can tell you from all the cities that I've gone to, I've realized that what we have are nationalist centers. Yeah, they have Islamic culture in them. They have Islamic traditions in them. That's true. All of them do. But the overwhelming character of them is a nationalist character. And if I was going to go a step further, then I would just substitute. If we're linking the Imam Hussein's days and times with our day and time, we would say these masajid are masajid of Bani Umayyah and masajid of Yazid. That's if we can look beyond culture and traditions. The problem is most of us define our Islamic character primarily by culture and tradition. We just haven't made that transition or that leap from the particular culture or the particular nationalism to become Muslim first and then whatever last. We become hyphenated Muslims. We are Sunnis first. We are Arabians first. We are whatever. I don't want to get on most people's sensitivities. We become that first. And then, as a matter of fact, yes, we are Muslims. And you can't argue with anyone. You come to him and say, wait a minute. I think, there's something to reconsider, to think about right here. We are Muslims before everything else. Some of us even have, and this is related to what Imam al-Husayn, I'm not going off on tangents here. This is part and parcel of that struggle that brought about his heroic end. When you come to certain masajid, different parts of the world, you see in some masjid, they have their activities here. Look, in North America, in Canada and the United States, everyone speaks English. Right? Okay. If everyone speaks English and you know where you're located and you are free of nationalism, that's not a consideration. It's very minor in your mind and heart. Then why do you conduct your programs in that other language? Even if it is the Arabic language, the world around here doesn't speak Arabic. Where do you live? On the moon somewhere? You are here in this society. Can't you know that you have to speak the language of the people that you are located in? But you don't want to do that. Why? Because there's an overriding character that you have that interposes itself between the Islam that you're supposed to be and the real character that you are. I'm not going off on tangents and speaking to you about something, what is he talking about? No. These are everyday facts that are related to the history that we're speaking about. وما أرسلنا من رسول إلا بلسان قومه. We have never commissioned a messenger except that he speaks the language of his people. Why do we speak another language? Who are we? What is our mission? What are we going to accomplish if we're going to keep on going around in a vicious cycle of a nationalist and cultural and traditional and sectarian character? Where are you going with this? It should be enough to understand that the Imam al-Husayn, in just a footnote of the lessons that we can learn from his lifetime, from his struggle, from his jihad, from his shahada, from his martyrdom, to be able to shed this asabiyya that we have. It was this asabiyya that killed him, and it is this asabiyya that is stifling and killing us. That's why we are 50 to 60 nation states in the world. That's another way of saying long live Muawiyah and Yazid. But how many of us are tuned into this fact? وَأَنَّ هَذِهِ أُمَّتُكُمْ أُمَّةً وَاحِدَةً. Allah says, this is your ummah, one ummah. Why are we not one ummah? We have people, I've attended a lot of sessions, a lot of presentations, and many learned individuals speak. They speak about an ummah. I ask, where? What ummah are you speaking about? Allah says that we are one ummah, that we are an ummah when we are one ummah. But if we're not one ummah, we are no ummah. It was early at that time, before things got out of political control, that the Imam al-Husayn tried to stop this flow, this political flow in the wrong direction. And the nationalist current overcame him. Why haven't we learned throughout all of these years to put an end to this nationalist current? There's a lot to say, but there's only limited time that I was given. I hope I've communicated to you something. I know I wasn't very conventional and very traditional in what I said. And I will say it again, I did not mean to harm anyone's feelings. I did not mean to score any points. The only thing I tried to do was try to communicate the truth to you as I understand it, from mind and from heart together. As-salamu ala al-imam al-Husayn, wa ala ashab al-imam al-Husayn, wa ala atba' al-imam al-Husayn. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته وصلى الله على محمد وآل محمد